Okay, so today we're going to continue with our introduction to looking at an example virus, Vienna, that we started last time, and talk a little more generally about other ways viruses have worked. Start out some logistical stuff and review from last time. So there's an assembly programming assignment. It's out. You should be aware of that. Also, some anonymous feedback. Please make the homeworks due at midnight instead of 8 p.m. It's much easier to find time to work on homework later at night. So I'm afraid when I decided to do 8 p.m., this was exactly what I was fearing, which is that I don't want the peak demand for questions on the homework to be like after 6 p.m. on Friday, because I probably can't really answer your questions then that very often. I'd be open to moving the homework deadline later if people think that it's okay that if you ask for help after 6 p.m., you know, I might not respond until, you know, Saturday. So, people who, given that caveat, would prefer them do it midnight to 8? People who would prefer them do it 8? Okay, so I can move, I'll think about it a bit, but probably I can move the deadlines for a few homeworks I haven't announced yet to midnight, given that. But my main concern is that, you know, I might be doing things Friday evening. I don't want to feel like I have to answer your questions at 8 p.m. on Friday. So that's why things are the way they are. So last time we talked about a bit about x86 encoding and a bunch of special stuff in x86. And my explanation of the encoding was a bit sloppy. When there was a question on whether this and this had add RAX RAX or add parentheses RAX RAX had the same opcode, can't have the same opcode. And they can. This is one of the things the mod part of the RM is for. I don't know why I didn't see it on the table I was surely projecting while trying to answer that question. It is. And we also started the Vienna virus. But as I said, my explanation was a bit sloppy and people were very confused. And as I mentioned, the reason I'm talking about x86 encoding is so you have a place to go if looking at object dump and what the assembler does isn't enough. That you don't have to just throw up your hands and give up. In cases where you might need to have machine code for an assignment. So I have hopefully a more understandable short version that you can review later if this comes up of what the encoding is. So we have our prefixes, opcode, then something called modRM, which is just name, then SIB, then displacement or immediate. That's the what's in an instruction. And some of these can be empty. So there can be zero prefixes, there can be no SIB byte. There can be no displacement or immediate. If there's one register in instruction, we use the modRM byte to have a number representing that register. If there's two registers, we use the modRM byte to have two numbers representing those two registers. If there's three registers, we use one part of the modRM byte and two parts of the SIB byte to have the numbers representing those registers. So that's the basic idea, but the modRM and SIB fields that hold register numbers sometimes are 3 bits long, and we have 16 registers on 64-bit, so there's this prefix that goes in the prefixes, which has space for an extra bit for up to 3 register numbers. And that's where those extra register numbers go. That's how we get R8, even though in the mod RM byte, we only have 3 bits to store a register number. We store the extra part in this REX prefix. So any questions on this? Yeah. So the question is, can there be more than one prefix? And the answer is yes, there absolutely can. And you will probably end up seeing instructions with more than one prefix. Any other questions? Okay, so, and before we go back to viruses, a brief note on the ASM assignment. So about what it is. You have to write a function called volume and density. This function has two 32-bit outputs. So not 64-bit. They're ints. Ints are 32-bit on the system, on our reference Linux system. And there was something I didn't mention about how assembly files produce symbol tables that are used by the linker. So we want this volume and density function to be accessible from another file, a C file we provide you. And by default, when you put a label in your assembly file, it produces a symbol which the linker could use. But it doesn't use those symbols by default. By default, they're marked as local. So symbols are only for the current file and basically exist for the linker to combine multiple things in the current file or for debuggers. So if you want the symbol, in this case our function, to be usable elsewhere, you need to have a global symbol. And the way you tell the assembler that I want a global symbol for this label is with the GNU assembler, the one we're using, is this .global directive, which for some reason is not spelled with an A. I added this to the assignment today, but we didn't cover it, and you probably need to know it. Okay, any questions about the assignment in general? Okay, so let's go back to Vienna then. So we had our virus, which infected a very simple kind of executable. These COM files, which had none of this header information, none of these multiple segments. They're just a block of stuff that's loaded directly into memory. And Vienna's strategy for adding itself to the executable was to append its code to the end, and then arrange for it to be run at the beginning of the executable by inserting a jump at the beginning to that code, which was then later fixed up back into what the original code was by having an extra copy of what was there before Vienna added stuff. And when we finished off, we were talking about how Vienna managed to put its code at the end of the binary at an address it didn't know in advance, in memory and in the binary, and how it made that still work. How it did the job of the linker without having to actually like write a whole linker in the virus, which would be ridiculous. And the main strategy was similar to what we saw with how dynamic linking works. Dynamic linking avoided making replacements all over the code by having these stubs and those, which did a lookup in a table. So there's only that table to update. And Vienna has this similar strategy where they make there be very little to update. So there's very little use of absolute addresses to refer to other parts of the virus code. And when they do need to compute an absolute address, they have this base register, which points to the beginning of the data part of the virus, which is just the end of the code. So it points to some known location in that virus segment. And they can add and subtract from that to get absolute addresses when they need it. And they do that sort of by hand, rather than trying to fix up all the places an address might appear in the actual machine code. And I was a little imprecise. I said there's no, it's all relative addresses. Of course, when Vienna is referring to the executable it infected, like when it's referring to that start address, that's an absolute address, but that's okay, that doesn't change. That's defined by our executable format. But addresses within what it appends do change, so that has to be, so all the accesses are relative to this value set by a move instruction. So this means that there's one thing that needs to be fixed up, and that's what this move instruction, which has, in our example, hex 8FD, which happened to be an address in a known place in this virus, in that executable. But in another executable that's shorter, it's going to be less, that's longer, it's going to be more. And so before Vienna can copy its code and data to that new executable, it needs to fix this. And the solution is that Vienna just edits the machine code in place. It edits the actual code for move. It computes based on SI. It subtracts to find the address of the second byte of this move instruction where the constant is stored and writes to that constant. And before we finished up last time, we pointed out that this was okay to do, even though it's code that's conceptually that we're running the virus right now and we're modifying its code, because it's not actually modifying code that's going to be run again. It's all, by the time we get to modifying that move, we've already ran it for our current configuration and set SI correctly. We aren't going to mess up what SI is set to. We aren't going to mess up what we're doing now. We're just setting up what we want to copy rather than making an extra copy of it and modifying that copy.
So this is
okay. So given that relocation, you know, the other thing that they had to do to fix things up was to write back to the jump instruction from. And that was all that Vienna did to fix up the executable and to fix up itself to run where it is. So Vienna has this strategy where it needs to actually do a little bit of updates to its code to work. So it turns out that I'm not sure why they did that. So that's not actually necessary. So you can actually write code that in x86, which doesn't need any changes to refer to things relatively. You don't need to have an address hard-coded in there somewhere. It's not intuitive, and it's not something your compiler is going to generate, but it's not actually that hard. So what you can do is you can sort of use the call instruction not to make a function call, but to push an address, push the address of an instruction on the stack. So if you remember how the call instruction works, is that it pushes the return address, which is the address of whatever instructions after the call on the stack. So if we call, say, this instruction labeled next, which happens to be afterwards, it's going to push the address of what happens to be after the call on the stack. And if that next thing is a pop, we're going to read that into a register. So this is a way that on x86 you can figure out what the address of your current instruction is, even if it happens to be copied between different locations in memory. And this is in fact commonly used by other viruses. Why Vienna went through the extra effort of actually overwriting a move instruction, I don't know. And this works with relocation because it happens that the target address of the call is encoded relatively. It's relative to the address of the following instruction. So this call here is encoded with offset 0, meaning that it's 0 bytes from the address of the next instruction. And that doesn't change based on where you put the call instruction. So any questions on this call and pop? Yeah.
Does it point straight to pop, or is it
When people do this, usually they just call right straight to pop, and usually it's usually the next instruction, so usually like this, because why waste space? But you don't have to. So there's one remaining question that I didn't answer about Vienna, which is how it keeps files from getting infinitely long. So Vienna wants to add itself to executables. And if it just always found a COM file and just appended itself to it, and you ran that file thousands of times, you know, it's some game you like, you run it every day, it eventually would get huge, and you'd run out of space. And that wouldn't be very subtle. Wouldn't really work. So how does Vienna keep itself from reinfecting files over and over again? This doesn't cause a correctness problem, because if Vienna did its procedure to add itself to a file it was already in, the file would be set up so it runs the copy of Vienna at the end, then restores the original jump to the older copy of Vienna, runs that, which restores the original code in the normal application. So it's not a correctness issue, but it's certainly, would be bad for performance, and you'd run out of file system space. And one thing that you could imagine doing is that Vienna could just look in the file and figure out, you know, whether its code was in there. It could look for some way of identifying its code and find it. But that's pretty slow, because that means you're going to go through all the effort of reading every executable file you find and searching for a particular thing somewhere in there. And you have to write all the code to figure out what string to search for. So like many viruses, Vienna does something much simpler. It marks the files it's infected in the metadata. It does it in the metadata, so it doesn't even have to read the files. It just asks for the sort of information you'd see in ls-l or in Windows Explorer if you like look at all the modification times and things like that. So they just found some space in the metadata to do that. And the space they found is not intuitive at all, but they took advantage of something weird that DOS decided to do. So they store the information about whether a file is infected or not in the last written time. And to explain how they do this, you have to look at how DOS encodes last written times. So DOS really didn't want to use much space for this. So they encoded as two 16-bit numbers to encode a date and time, which isn't very much space. And they also don't want to do like lots of arithmetic like you typically see on a modern system to figure out what date it is. So they don't do something like store number of seconds since some fixed date like Linux does. They store, in fact, year, month, day, and hour, minute, second. They just have some bits of each of those numbers reserved for the year, reserved for the month, reserved for the day. And they just mask and shift those out. And this leads to some peculiarities. So this month field here is 4 bits. So we can store months from 0 to 15, whatever those numbers would represent. We have a little, we're wasting space in order to avoid you need to do date calculations. And that's the sort of thing that Vienna takes advantage of. Now, putting it in the month would not be very subtle, because you ask for a directory listing, and then your directory listing application says, hey, something's wrong with this file. Which would probably be caught. But there's a similar problem in this sec field. So this, what I've labeled sec divided by 2, stores 5 bits, so it ranges from 0 to 31. And this stores the number of seconds in the last written time divided by 2. So you can represent 0 seconds after a minute, 2, 4, 6, and so on. If you want to store that a file was modified 5 seconds after a minute, you can't do that. You need to choose 4 or 6. But it ranges from 0 to 31, so it's from 0 seconds to 62 seconds. And probably no files are ever modified 62 seconds after a minute. Probably never even modified 60 seconds after a minute. So Vienna just sets this to 62 seconds. Sets the field to 31. That's never going to happen naturally. And Vienna needed to modify this anyways, because you might notice if the last written time changed on all your executables. So it's stealthy, you know, better for the virus to modify the last written times back to what they were originally. But instead of doing that, Vienna just changes the seconds field, which usually doesn't get displayed to the user or is not really noticed. And this sort of trick of modifying some sort of file metadata or having some easy mark in a file is a common thing that viruses do. Maybe not a great idea, but it's a common thing they do because they're inevitably running on a system where they've already infected things. And this is something they actually need to avoid, or it's going to go out of control on a single system, and that means that no one's going to spread copies of the virus. They're just going to say, my computer's broken, rather than give someone a file. So any questions on Vienna overall? before we move on to talking about viruses more generally. Okay, so Viana made some particular choices, and we're going to talk about options for two of them that we see in this sort of self-propagating malware that embeds itself in things like executables. So one question is, where do you hide your code? You have to add your code somewhere, and there's lots of options actually about where exactly you place it. Viana chose a particular option, which was it appended it to an executable. But that's not the only thing that you can do, and they have different results as far as how easy it is to detect, how easy it is to implement your virus, etc. The other issue is how you get your code ran. So in Viana's case, Viana needed to modify part of the real executable's code and then unmodify it to make the executable work. So this is not one of the easier strategies, and in fact is a lot harder on a modern system where if you try to write to random executable code as it's normally loaded, you'll get an error. But there are other things you can do which are simpler than what Viana did to get your code run. So let's start by talking about options about where to put code. And so we're going to have some considerations we should think about here when we look at the options. The one is that, is the way we're putting our code in there, is it going to stop people from actually copying the file places where our code is put? Are they files that users actually care about? And is it actually stealthy? When Viana modifies an executable, it changes the size, but hopefully users do not memorize what the sizes of all their executables are. At the time where viruses were popular, maybe some users did this, but it's not usually a thing you do. So that's reasonably so, but you could do better. And so I'm going to go through some options so that all of these are things that real malware has done. So one option is you can just replace the entire executable code. So you have some original executable that you find on the disk that you want to infect, so you just put your virus there instead. Maybe you call the worm if you do this. Any problems with this? Yeah? Yeah, so this your executable is broken as far as the user is concerned. This seems horribly non-subtle. Seems like you won't get anywhere. But it turns out that real viruses have done this. So one, probably the most famous example is there was the 2000 I Love You worm, which was written in Visual Basic, which is a reason why they would replace executables, because Visual Basic is not a language that is as convenient to just copy machine code in, because it's not machine code, into an executable. So they just replaced the executable with a Visual Basic file with the same name as far as visible to the user. And it spread via email. So it works still, because by the time you ran it, it was too late. It had gone through your address book and sent an email to everyone with a copy of itself. And most of the actual long-term impact of the I Love You worm was because it had this strategy. Because it replaced normal executables and other files, like documents, Word documents, with copies of itself. It caused a lot of damage just by spreading, by destroying those things. Yes?
How did it spread? Oh, so are you saying, the moment you ran it and realized that your executable was broken, you run the code and then
it's like... Yeah, it's too late. We run the code and I think it looked at an Outlook address book and sent a message to everyone in the address book. Yes? No, so what this did is it deleted the original executable or another file, and created a file with the same name and the extension for a Visual Basic script, and with an icon to look the same. Yes. So the user had to click or open it, but because this infected like executables and like doc files, it found things that users were likely to click. And likely to click even after they knew they were infected. So this isn't particularly subtle. But you see it a lot because it doesn't involve any reasoning about machine code or relocating assembly, all that really inconvenient stuff that the Vienna virus had to do. So it's attractive. But you know, it's not particularly stealthy. So can anyone think of a way of, you know, being able to still write your virus in something like Visual Basic and not have to worry about machine code? And still be able to have it be stealthy. What can you do? back there?
You could make it copy the original executable to some hidden location and then have Visual Basic script call the executable.
So the suggestion is that to be stealthy, we just need to save a copy of the original executable somewhere else and run that. And this is exactly a strategy that some have used. Often they put it in the same file, but rather than elsewhere, because that means you can move it around and it still works. So you take your original executable and you replace it with something which starts with your virus code and then has a copy of the original executable at the end. And you have some code at the end of your virus, which instead of jumping back to the original executable code like we did in Vienna after fixing something up, takes this whole thing, makes a temporary file, and runs it. So this is not particularly, this is more subtle. So if you do this right, user might not notice that it's not running under the same name. Usually doesn't come up. And this is pretty effective at hiding it. And this allows you to not worry about changing machine code around or anything. All you need to do is figure out how to make the executable be a big string in your program. So the other option we saw was just putting it after the executable code. That was what we did with Vienna. So the basic strategy is you put your virus code at the end, and somewhere in the middle of this executable, you need to somehow insert a jump to that code you added to the end. So in Vienna, this was pretty simple. They just put the code at the end, and it worked. They need to have the jump, but that wasn't actually that hard. You just needed a jump to with the appropriate offset. This is not going to be so simple in a modern executable format, but viruses still do this. So with a modern executable format, they have lengths. So if you remember when I showed you that list of load directives, they had an amount of space in the file to use and an amount of space in memory to use. So if you want to add something to the end of an executable and have it work, you need to update the beginning what those lengths are, or add another segment that points to the data you added. So in addition to this not being stealthy because you made the executable bigger, so maybe someone could look for that, you also need to do more work on a modern system, which is to actually update that header so your code actually gets loaded into memory. So typically, if you just add something to the end of an executable, most of that will not be loaded into memory. Maybe a little of it will, because there's some rounding in how program loaders work. They might load a little extra more than they need to, but generally it won't be loaded, unless you change the header to say, yes, this is really part of what you should load. And this means, of course, that if you write a virus for a modern system, they need to actually have some parser for this header, and hopefully they actually get it right. or else they can really mess up the executable. Okay, so those are the most obvious strategies. And all these strategies we've looked at so far are not subtle from sort of a file metadata perspective. If you want to look for viruses doing this, as say a maker of antivirus software, you can just look at executables and see if they're changing size. It's probably a pretty good indicator that something weird is happening. And so you might want to avoid this as a virus writer, because this is something that's really cheap to do to detect viruses, and really not invasive to do. So you might want to keep files the same size. Now this seems like a problem because you want to add something to the executable, so of course you need more space. Can anyone think of a simple solution to that? Yeah. So you could get rid of something in the executable. So that's an option. So we could just overwrite part of the executable and hope it doesn't matter. I don't think this is unheard of, but it's not common, just because you usually want to infect unknown executables and you're worried about breaking something. So usually you won't just overwrite some arbitrary part, but maybe you'd overwrite something you think usually doesn't matter, and we'll talk later that there are some things which usually don't matter in executables. Yes?
Compress it and then uncompress it when you want to, right?
Yeah, so another strategy is we could compress it, and that's a real thing that some viruses did. So this is another thing you can do in a high-level language, is that you take your original executable and you compress it. Executables are meant to have the data to be loaded into memory. They aren't actually that space efficient as far as compressibility. They're usually pretty compressible. So you take something like gzip or zip, compress it, store that compressed executable inside, and use the same run it from a temp file strategy. Except this time, to produce your temp file, you decompress this first. And you can add some padding at the end to make sure it's exactly the same size as the original. So this is something that we really see with things which replace the executables. This is one viable strategy, and it's also one where at no point in this process did I need to care about machine code or executable formats. Any questions on this? So another strategy you alluded to is that you know, we could just overwrite part of the executable. To make that work, we need to hope that that part is unused. And it turns out that there's gonna be some unused code, but this doesn't make sense. Why would a program have unused stuff? Why are we wasting space on all of our hard drives storing stuff that is never used? But you probably saw this when you were doing the RE homework, that there is unused code in there. So we have, for example, have this jump here. And right after the jump is a no-op. This is a funny no-op. It's a no-op which takes a register memory, it takes a memory argument, but it's a no-op. It doesn't do anything, it just happens to take an argument because it's actually encoded like something which takes arguments, even though those arguments aren't used. And then, you know, later on we have another jump. And this is just from a normal executable on my laptop. You have this other jump right after a jump. There's no way this no-op can get run because this jump just always skips over it. Similarly, we have a ret here. We probably aren't returning to this sequence of two no-ops, but we have them in there. And so this is something you commonly see. This is one form of just unused space. So there are instructions here. You could run them, but there's absolutely no way that our program is actually going to reach those no-op instructions. So why are they there? Any ideas, guesses? Why did the compiler or assembler decide to put them there? Yeah?
It makes something else they're doing easier for whatever reason. It makes moving the process from changing to high level to low level.
So one idea is that maybe it makes things easier. Okay, any other? Yeah. So your idea is that it needs CPU time to wait. So that would be true if these no-ops were being run. But you see this no-op right here is after a jump, so we can't even run it. There are also no-ops which can be run, but I deliberately chose ones which can't. Yeah. So it could help with finding, making addresses easier to find. Okay, so one idea is that maybe it helps out with linking. So, okay, any other ideas? Yeah.
Maybe for aligning things.
So one idea is about alignment. So alignment turns out to be the reason. It's kind of related to making addresses more convenient. But rather than making addresses more convenient for the linker or the assembler to compute instructions, we're going to make addresses more convenient for the processor. So in fact, if you look in Intel's optimization reference manual, they tell you all branch targets should be 16-byte aligned. This is as an optimization. This is not required for correctness. But they're telling you that your code will be faster if you align all branch targets to 16 bytes. And a branch target is anything that you jump to or call, etc. Any of those things that you go to via some instruction that's not going to just the next instruction. Intel is telling you it should be 16-byte aligned. That means the first byte of that instruction should start on an memory address, which is a multiple of 16. In this class, we're not going to go into detail about why you do this in hardware. The summary is that it's almost certainly better for the instruction cache, which you'll learn about in 3330. It's better for instruction decode logic, which you'll have a maybe get some of an idea in 3330, but we don't go into enough detail on how modern instruction decoding works to explain this. But it turns out to be better for the hardware. So the compiler is helping out the hardware by making sure that things are on these 16-byte boundaries, which means that we insert like 15 bytes of junk to make sure that happens. Unused junk that a virus could put something in and it wouldn't change how the program works.
I don't think I've ever seen knobs outputted like in GCC if you pass the dash test. So are those added in by the linker?
So the question is, I've never seen these knobs when I use GCC dash S. What's happening? So typically, if you in the .s file, these won't be represented as nops. Instead, there will be an assembler directive saying, I want this thing aligned. And the assembler, when it reads that directive, will generate the appropriate amount of nops. Rather than the compiler doing it itself, the compiler could do it itself, but the compiler isn't actually, when it's generating the assembly file, tracking how much space there is until the next multiple of 16. It doesn't know how long instructions are yet. And so that's why I asked the assembler to do it. Okay. So, any other questions? So some of you may be wondering, why are these filled with nops if they're never run? It doesn't matter what they're filled with. Why are we spending the time to generate this long nop instruction when we could put anything there? So one reason is because of the way the assembler does this, is that the compiler just says, I want this aligned, and the assembler wants to generate stuff to fill that gap that will work even if it happens to be reachable. So the assembler doesn't check whether the jump before is an unconditional jump or not. It just makes sure that it's filled with something that would work regardless of the case. It's also better for disassembly. So if we filled it with junk, that might confuse the disassembler when you use object dump and might make think object dump not realize where an instruction starts. Because the junk might be some instruction which, the first byte of some instruction which takes it multiple bytes, then followed by a real instruction. That would confuse the disassembler. And also, this is another thing the Intel optimization manual tells you to do. I'm not going to go into great detail about what about the processor would make this happen, except that you can think the short version is that the processor looks ahead a few instructions, and having not real instructions there will confuse it, even if it's not reachable. Will confuse it and slow it down. It won't be incorrect, but it will be slower. So it's what Intel will tell you to do, is to put a real instruction there rather than some junk. Okay, so this is the most prominent example of empty space in the executables we'll look at in this class. But there are other types of empty, unused space in real executables. So there's another example, which you can notice in executables you see here, that like the one in RE. And there's some others, most of which don't really seem to appear on Linux executables. At least consistently appear in Linux executables. They probably appear in some. So one is that there's unused dynamic linking structure. So the dynamic linker has a bunch of these sections in our executables to store information that it uses when it like loads a library and figures out how to fix up that global offset table we talked about. And if you look at them, sometimes they're not completely used. So for example, this is, I believe, dynamic linking section of some simple executable, and hey, it ends with all these zeros. And it turns out that if you decode the format of this, if you look up how the dynamic linking information format works, which I have to do, I don't expect you to know that, is that the encoding here is that the first part is the first two fields here are the name of something, some value, so like versim, so version information for libraries, and then a value. And it ends with something labeled null, meaning there's no more entries. And after that null, hey, there's a whole bunch of space. Turns out that for some, whatever reason, the linker didn't actually make this as small as it could. So we have all these bytes that we could put something in and no one would notice. The linker's gonna stop looking at this data structure here. This is still going to be loaded into memory because the linker wants to use it. So we could put code there and probably run it. So there are other types of empty space I talked about here. So one is that, you know, there might be debugging or symbol table information. So you need debugging information. But if it's in your executable, that stuff your debugger uses, if you're not running a debugger, hey, you could put whatever you want there and it will still work. The program loader is not gonna check that all the parts of the file, executable file, are consistent. It's just gonna do what the loading instructions say to do. And similarly, for this reason, if there's space in, say, program headers that isn't really being used for something important, you can put virus code there. As long as you make the program tell the program loader to load it, it'll work. And as long as it's not something the program loader uses, it doesn't matter what you put there. And another kind of space you might have is space between segments. So this is something which apparently is very common on Windows. So on Windows, we talked about aligning things for the processor. Windows aligns segments. It seems that Linux doesn't do this, but Windows aligns segments to make things easier for the OS. And in doing this, this means that there's actually these big gaps of space frequently, not always, and doesn't necessarily have to be there, but often these big gaps of space between the different segments of an executable that are loaded. So one thing you might say is that all these sorts of cavities I've talked about are giving you these little bits of space. So even the sort of segment, the gaps between segments I talked about are like maybe a kilobyte. And you might want to have more code than that. You might not want your virus to be really, really small. So is there a solution? And one thing that some viruses have done is chain these cavities together. So maybe there's not enough space in any particular gap in an executable. There are all these little small gaps it finds, but it can find a big enough one somewhere. Enough of them together, and it can combine them. So the most obvious thing to do would be to put your code in there and then put a jump to the next one. But that's pretty annoying, actually. What's the problem with just, you know, copy whatever part of your code fits first, then whatever part of your code fits second, and then put a jump? Yeah?
You always need to have at least two spaces, and you can't, your compare statement's going to be messed up by not being able to put them right next to each other.
So one idea is that your compares might be messed up. So it turns out that a jump doesn't change the flags used by compares. So that's not a problem. But there is something, but you said you need two spaces?
Yeah, you need to be able to put something there and then a jump always.
Okay, but you need space for the jump, so that's a little constraining. So that's limit, you're not using the space very efficiently. Yeah, some.
The opcode between the empty spaces and the virus doesn't match up.
What do you mean between? Amount of bits used for the instructions? Yeah, so another concern is that on x86, we have instructions of different lengths. So if you did this process of put the first bit here and then a jump, you need to make sure that you're putting a whole instruction at the end there. So you need to figure out how long your instructions are. And we talked about the information you need to do that when we talked about x86 instruction coding, and it involved like looking things up in tables. Like you could code this logic, and some viruses have coded that logic, which we'll talk about much later because they didn't encode it for this reason, but it's very inconvenient. So is there some alternate strategy which avoids worrying about how long opcodes are? Or say writing everything so all your instructions are 4 bytes long? Yeah. Yeah. How? How would you avoid the problem of?
Oh, that one's
not good. So one idea. So one thing. I'll give you an example of something the CIH Chernobyl virus did. So it was a pretty big virus, and it wanted to hide in the gaps between segments. And each one of those is maybe like a kilobyte at most. And it was bigger than that. So what they did is they had some startup code, which they put near the beginning, in a gap near the beginning of the executable, and they put a list of where the code was. And they didn't do any worrying about, let's add jumps, let's split up instructions. They didn't do any of that. They just copied their code just as is. And the startup code just reassembled the virus in memory. So a very simple and elegant solution. Just have this table of where the load code is and just reassemble it and then run out. So it's effectively the virus wrote a little loader, program loader for itself with its own little program header telling it where it found places to stash stuff. Any questions about this idea? Yeah.
How exactly does it reassemble it?
So the startup code reads this list of code locations. And then it allocates memory based on the size of that and just goes through the list and copies each little segment according to what the table said, where the table says it is and how big it says it is. And then it jumps to the beginning of that. Yeah. No. Like you can even, because it's reassembling it like this, it could even be the case that part one ends in the middle of an instruction. That's fine because we're going to put the two instructions back together before we actually run anything. Or put the two parts of the instruction. So there's some other options about where viruses might put code. And we've talked about sort of infecting executables or replacing normal files like Word documents that users use. But there's other places you can put your code. And a particularly attractive one for viruses has been inside operating system code. This is probably not the way a virus spreads to other users, because you typically do not give users a copy of your OS, but it's a way to spread to other programs. And it's also particularly hard to remove such viruses. And probably the most pernicious kind of these viruses and operating system codes are ones which deal with the boot process, how the operating system gets started. So there's a bunch of code which runs when we start a machine, and that this is a target for putting your virus code, a place to put your virus code. So one is that when we start our processor, when our machine starts up, you know, it's not the case that the processor can talk directly to your hard drive or SSD. It needs to run some code to do that. It doesn't have the logic built in. And so there's usually a chip on the motherboard next to your processor, which has this code to load stuff from a hard drive. This is called BIOS or EFI. A chip on the motherboard, it's usually extremely CPU and motherboard specific code. And that's what actually runs absolutely first. And what that code does is it has enough that it knows how to like read a hard drive. And from something like a hard drive, it looks at a fixed known location on the disk and reads what's called a bootloader. So it copies from the hard drive a piece of code written by your operating system maker, which actually knows how to read the whole operating system from the disk. And this code, unlike the BIOS code, will typically like know about your file system. It will know what about directories. The BIOS code is not meant to be OS specific, so it doesn't know about directories or anything like that. It's not going to know about the details of loading your OS. But this bootloader code loaded from disk that your OS supplies will. So it's going to do the rest, the OS specific part of loading the OS. And then this bootloader code typically does the simplest thing to start using files on the file system. So just normal files on your file system, like running a program. Just the minimal code to get there. And the second part of this process, this bootloader, has been a very popular target for malware. Because it's loaded, always loaded first. And it's not easy to change. It's not commonly looked at by users. And more than that, it used to be the case, back in DOS, that it was common to share bootable floppies around. It was common for machines to be configured to boot from an inserted floppy. So you could actually spread viruses this way. Like, unlike a modern machine, you typically don't do that. You typically aren't going to be booting from media someone else gave you, but this was more common in the DOS days that your machine might do that. And you might deliberately do that. And so having a sort of modifying the bootloader of an inserted floppy would be an actual way to spread your virus. Because people who have that floppy inserted would often run it automatically when the machine booted. And the way bootloaders worked on historically and often still today is that there's the first sector, the first 512 bytes of the device, contains a bootloader and information about partitions, information about how the rest of the hard drive or floppy disk is divided up into pieces. And there's code in the BIOS which copies this bootloader into RAM at a known location and starts running it. And the BIOS generally also provides some functionality to help do I/O. Like some basically like a little library for here's how you read from disk on this platform, to help the bootloader get started. And so bootloader viruses do a simple thing of replacing the bootloader with the virus code. But they still need to do, just like we have with executables, you want to run the real executable. In this case, you want to run the real bootloader, which means you need to put a copy of the real bootloader somewhere. And unlike applications, we're not going to have holes in our bootloaders. This is 512 bytes that you have to fit your bootloader in typically there's, and sorry, it's 512 bytes, and you have a partition table that you can't overwrite. So you have less than 512 bytes to fit this bootloader. So typically bootloaders do not have much extra space. So if you want to keep the original around, you're not going to get away with just compressing it and storing it somewhere. You're not going to find bundles of no-ops in there. It's going to be much tighter than that. So like the strategy the Stone Virus use, is it just decided, oh, I'm just going to write the bootloader to Sector 6. That's probably okay. Maybe there's some data there, who knows? And I think the most common file system worked, there usually wasn't data there. Not always. But that was the stretch. So they copied the original bootloader to this fixed location on the disk, then inserted their virus code, which reads that when it's done and jumps to it. And if this done wrong, well, it turns out that this bootloader virus sometimes, you know, erase people's data. Okay. So, yeah, allegedly there was unused space in that part of the file system usually. This is according to Zur, so that was usually true. I didn't find actual evidence in that, trying to figure out what the file system layout of FAT12, which is what I think they were using at the time, was. But it probably worked often enough that it didn't get them into trouble. But it's not exactly a safe strategy, but this is commonly things that these sorts of viruses do, because you're writing code that runs before there's a file system. You can't, if you want to figure out where to make a file, you need to write the OS code that implements the file system yourself, because it's not loaded yet. Okay, so modern bootloaders work very differently. And I'm mentioning this because there's some features which are basically a response to these bootloader viruses in modern bootloaders. So BIOS, which is this old technology, is going away. And the other thing is UEFI, stands for Universal Extensible Firmware Interface. This is the new version of BIOS. And this is basically a lot fancier than BIOS. So like the BIOS, it provides like a library for how do I read from the disk, and knows how to load the initial bootloader code. Unlike the BIOS, this UEFI thing actually has some understanding of file systems. So it's much, you know, so it's not this arcane thing where there's this special bootloader program which doesn't appear as a file. On UEFI, the bootloader programs actually look like files, are files, because the UEFI understands some file systems. And UEFI was written after bootloader viruses were around, and they're really annoying. They're really hard to get rid of. Because you need to know, you can't, wiping out your OS might not fix it. You know, because it's not on the, if you replace all your files, it doesn't get rid of a bootloader virus. That's why they were so effective. So UEFI has something called Secure Boot, which is combats things like bootloader viruses. And the idea is that the UEFI implementation checks the bootloader code and sees what it is and fails if it's not okay. So it somehow actually makes sure you're loading a good bootloader. So what would be a good strategy for figuring out what a good bootloader is? Yeah. Okay, so one idea is we could try to look at what the bootloader code does and try to see if it copies things it shouldn't be or something like that. So that's not very reliable, unfortunately. So any other ideas? So it's something we'll talk about doing, but for this, you want to have a great yes or no answer. So, yeah.
If it matches a backup closely enough.
Okay, so another idea is you could have another copy of it and hope that the bootloader virus isn't smart enough to modify both copies. Yeah. So we could have something like a digest of it stored somewhere. So that's closer. So the way secure boot works is probably closest to that hash digest sort of form. Storing another copy of it would just invite the bootloader to be smart enough to figure out where that other copy is, unless you hit it. Seems complicated, and you need to install bootloaders legitimately, right? If I install a new OS that needs a new kind of bootloader, it needs to be able to install a bootloader. Like, we can't make it so you can't install bootloaders. So the way secure boot works is it uses cryptographic signatures. So I'm not going to talk about how cryptography works, except to tell you about what signatures are. So signatures mean you have a private key, which can be used to create what is called a digital signature. And with a public key that anyone can have, you can verify that the signature is genuine, as in was created by someone who had the private key. So as long as you keep the private key secret and only allow that private key to be used for good bootloaders, this keeps you from ever booting from a virus bootloader. So the idea here is that somehow we know that a known authority who controls this private key vouched for the bootloader. This has been controversial because this same mechanism which keeps us from loading virus bootloaders seems like it's also something which keep users from installing the OS of their choice. But the theory is that users could add their own keys. That the same interface you use to install new OSs lets you install a new key if you don't trust any of these known authorities. So you can be your own authority. Or trust, Ubuntu to be their own authority. And there's another question, which is, well, if changing the bootloader is not something the virus can do, why wouldn't they just change the OS? Or change some basic startup code in the OS after the boot, after that 512 bytes or so, whatever small thing the bootloader is. And the theory behind secure boot is that if you really want that security, you can write a smart bootloader, a bootloader which sort of does this again, that just like the UEFI implementation checks a signature, the bootloader itself can read the OS files and take a signature on those. So any questions about secure boot? So another place which is worth noting as a target is this first step of the boot process, that thing which is in a chip on your motherboard. And this has been a real target of malware, but generally not of commonly spread viruses. And probably the main reason for that is that this code is extremely non-portable. That if you write a virus that works at that stage, you need to figure out how to do disk I/O again, yourself, for a particular type of disk controller that's on that motherboard. And it's going to vary between different motherboards. Also, there's actually some protection for updates. So for example, many systems will require those updates to be cryptographically signed. So if you aren't, Intel or whoever made the motherboard, you really can't do it. But this is an attractive technique because if you thought, bootloaders are pretty subtle, you don't often change your bootloader, and you might not change it when you upgrade your operating system. So reinstalling your OS might not remove a bootloader virus. These are really hard to remove. You can replace your hard drive and it's still there. And these do exist, have been reported to exist, to persist other malware. So basically someone writes a bootloader, a BIOS kit, a new version of the BIOS, which detects if some other malware is there, and if not, copies it back in. And this has been reported to be used by people who are generally not distributing viruses to go everywhere, but targeting particular groups. So there's a third sort of thing in this boot process we have, which is that there's operating system files. So we talked about viruses just infecting executables and things, you know, before the operating system runs, which is nice and subtle. But the other thing we can do is we can just add new operating system files. So for example, one thing you can do to, if you want your virus code to run, is you can make it a startup program. You know, you don't need to depend on the user starting an executable you've infected. You can run yourself on boot. You can tell the OS, this is a program which needs to run every time. Or you can, in fact, deliberately choose a system program that's run rather than something you expect the user to click on. Okay, so we talked a lot about where we can put code. So any questions about these various options for placing code? So various ways of putting it in executables and ways of subverting how the operating system works to find more subtle places we can put virus code. So the other half of it is gets into how do we get code run. We'll probably continue this next time, given the time. And we talked about sort of some options already. So one option was the bootloader. In addition to being a place to put code, you know, that's a good place to put our virus code, it's a way to get our code run. You know, so it's a very subtle place to hide code, you know, as long as we keep a backup copy of the bootloader somewhere. But it also is a way to get our code run. But there's some other ways we can get our code run, which are simpler or more difficult. And the simplest one is we can change the starting location. So in Vienna, they had to actually insert code change code that was already being run to effectively change where execution started. They need to insert that jump. In a modern executable format, you don't need to do that. So if you remember when we looked at object dump output, we have this start address that's in the header that tells us where does execution start in this program. And if you append code to the end of this executable and you want it to run, you can just change the start address to be the memory address your new code will be loaded at. And then you just somehow jump back to the original start address at the end of that code. So that's absolute simplest way to get your code run in a modern system. Vienna didn't do it because that wasn't an option in the COM format. If you wanted code to run first, you needed to put it at the beginning. But in a modern thing, you don't need to touch any of that old code with a real modern executable format. So another option is what we saw in Vienna. It's just edit code that's going to run anyways. And this takes multiple forms. So the form we saw in Vienna was the more complicated way. They edited code that probably did something useful, which meant that they needed to redo that useful thing to make it work. And it was worse than that because they might have edited multiple instructions and like half of one instruction. So they needed to actually restore the code back to run it, back in its original location, in order to have things consistently work. But we have other options. So, for example, I showed you some cavities earlier. Yeah, we had like a ret followed by this empty space because we were aligning the thing after the ret. So you had this empty, unused space. Well, why don't we just replace that with a jump? There happens to be space for it because we know that something right after a ret isn't actually code you can reach. Probably isn't code you can reach if it's a not. Why would a compiler insert a jump to a not after a ret? Especially a very long not. So it doesn't make sense to do that. So we can infer from this that that's probably unused space. And we could just replace this with a jump and not change the behavior. And as long as the code we jump to returns eventually, we won't change how the program behaves besides running our extra bit of code. And in fact, this is going to be the next assignment after the current one is going to be to do this. I'm going to give you an executable, which is going to have some empty space to put some virus code, which is really just going to print out a message. And I'm going to have you modify a function, which has some padding after it, to insert some sort of jump. So this is one easy opportunity where it's easy to identify those spaces, and you could imagine writing something which would go through a whole executable and find these automatically. Not going to have you do that, because that would involve making an x86 disassembler, basically, or part of one, but you could imagine doing that. But you know, in general, you know, it seems pretty challenging to do that. You know, we could replace sort of any instruction, but you know, we don't actually want to write a full instruction parser. And there's some challenges to just iterating through the assembly code to find out where each instruction is. And one of those is that you might have some non-instructions in the middle of code. So like a compiler might put a floating point constant in the code. And who knows what instructions that looks like. Here's what it looks like. It's 00008038. Those are the bytes it's represented as. That doesn't disassemble as anything. It's not a valid instruction. And if we just looked to try to disassemble the executable without knowing where functions started, we wouldn't have any idea what was going on. We'd get lost because we'd see something like this. We'd think at 3F maybe that we're in the middle of an instruction, and then we go to the next thing, and we never get our place back. So we need something a little smarter, and ideally we don't want to have some really complex logic to figure out where we are. So we want something simple, like Vienna didn't do anything complicated with machine code. It didn't have any like real understanding of x86 code. It just had hard-coded offsets, the simplest thing. But what you can do instead is you can look for patterns. So rather than like try to actually understand assembly code to figure out where instructions are, you just look for patterns and you have some way to make sure that you don't have too many false positives. So for example, a simple pattern you might look for to replace is a function call. And function calls typically use the EA opcode, you know, followed by the displacement from the PC. But if you just look for this anywhere in the program, especially without understanding what parts of the program are code and data, you'd have lots of false positives, most likely. So how can you avoid that? Well, you can use some heuristics based on where the function call points to, what this placement represents, to only include things which are probably function calls. So for example, on 32-bit x86, many very popular compilers started most functions with push EPB, push the frame pointer, and move the, move the frame pointer to the stack. I have the right instruction bytes, but the wrong assembly. But you have these sort of things that compilers commonly do that start functions. So you can look for one of those, and if you see the E8 opcode with an offset pointing to that, you can be pretty sure it's probably really a function call. And so this is a technique that viruses use, is that they look for common patterns that were big enough that they probably weren't just some data which happened to coincidentally have the same value as an instruction. So in this case, we're going to look for basically we're looking for one byte plus a displacement that is not too big. You know, so basically 5 bytes being right plus 3 bytes at the beginning of the thing is displaced. So we're looking for basically 8 bytes being coincidentally right. And that's not too likely to happen by chance. Okay. And it's about time. So next time we will talk about other places, other types of code we can modify, and finish up talking about viruses and move on to talking about sort of basic ways of detecting viruses and other malware.